Welcome to Word on the Street, a weekly podcast from Barclays where our experts help ordinary investors make sense of the latest news and events impacting the world's financial markets.
Welcome to another edition of Word on the Street. This week, we take on the latest from corporate earnings season. We've had quite a few of the biggest companies in the world telling us the latest. And also, we will cover the most recent updates from the world economy and capital markets, more broadly, with data and news flows trickling this week. We've got recessions, interest rates, inflation, geopolitics, election updates, plenty to cover as usual. So, Will, I think let's start with earnings season. Has the quarterly download from the world's public companies delivered anything of note to you and the team so far? In particular, I mean, I saw Meta, owner of Facebook and Instagram, very much in the news. Have you got much to say about that?
Yes. Have you been on Insta enough, Sophie? That's the question. No. Hello. And I've actually never been on Instagram, funny enough. I know my wife goes on it, but this is not a recommendation. The point there is that this is not a stock recommendation, as Sophie rightly points out. This is just something in the news. And I think, you know, so far we're only a little bit of the way through earnings season. And, you know, I think the main things to point out, the reminder here to point out is that this can often resemble a kind of game of cat and mouse between chief executives of the companies and the analysts for banks like Barclays and various others who are tasked with trying to kind of work out what the earnings are going to be before they're announced. And the chief executives and the business, they guide the analysts. And most of the time you find that, you know, analysts can start off a little too optimistic. They're then corrected a little bit as you get closer to the earnings season. And most of the time as well, you found that companies tend to beat expectations. So there is a bit of a sort of game about this whole piece. And generally, you have to be quite careful about trying to discern sort of signal through the noise as a long-term investor, particularly in amongst this kind of, you know, this deluge of earnings and sort of other information. There are some interesting points, though, I think. And, you know, you are seeing sort of tech. It's a big season for tech, in particular in the US, just because expectations are so high. And so really, you know, investors have been getting so excited about this space and AI and all sorts of other for some time as well, that, you know, you are seeing some of these companies struggle to hop over that extremely high bar. Elsewhere, though, I think, you know, there's no signs of sort of alarm just yet. We've had most of the, you know, the banks in the US, some of them in Europe as well. We obviously can't comment on Barclays. That's the one thing we can't comment on. But you know, across the sort of US space, certainly, there's no major causes for alarm in what we can see in terms of sort of what we're seeing in terms of underlying trends. So, yeah, it's been quite interesting. But I think, you know, the question that sort of, you know, that came into my head last night, just thinking about, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Meta, was talking about sort of, you know, the need to invest in artificial intelligence or this latest sort of batch of artificial intelligence. And some are speculating, you know, that if artificial intelligence, even large language models, you know, reach their potential, to what extent do we want this enormous power being wielded by, you know, individuals to a degree? You know, to what extent does the state need to get involved? And, you know, yes, it's a sort of risky moment.
Yeah, kind of, I guess, more on the moral side as well. I can see that from. But, I mean, these are the CEOs of these companies, though, so I suppose one could argue that they really have their position in that monopoly themselves, and the position they're in is because of kind of what they've done to get there, and they're the ones that are advancing technology and developing the AI.
Yeah, they are. And we seem to want, you're right, Sophie. And I think, you know, that can't be lost in translation. I mean, I think, you know, these guys, you know, a lot of them sort of household names now, you know, very, very rich people for a start. And they have, you know, there's certainly sort of decisions and bravery and sort of risk taking involved. And they've made the right strategic kind of calls a lot of the time. And that needs to be respected. And in a sense, like, you're seeing the market respect that. And I think, you know, certainly charismatic leadership can be really, you know, it's really important. But I think there are dangers therein. And again, you know, I'm sorry, you're going to sigh, but history is sort of littered with examples of people, charismatic leaders and kind of individuals where their power had gone too far and they kind of, you know, they not enough constraints on their kind of their brilliance to a certain degree. And eventually, you know, people make the wrong decision and then there's huge kind of consequences for all. And one of the examples people use from history is the, you know, the Venetian trading empire. sort of the early Middle Ages and the early modern period, I should say. And one of the interesting things about it was that this is a hugely innovative trading empire, but ultimately it kind of curdled at a point where the traders themselves, one generation, acquired too much. Or this is one of the arguments for why it didn't become sort of, you know, or still isn't with us to a degree, was that the traders of one generation managed to acquire too much political power. And so essentially what they were able to do is change the rules of the game in their favor. So they changed the field so that the next batch of innovators and disruptors and entrepreneurs in the trading sphere weren't able to access the sort of same opportunities they were. And that is why kind of that Venetian Empire kind of died on entrenched interest to a degree. And that's why, you know, the story of the UK a couple of hundred years later is so interesting, because suddenly we hit upon a recipe, an institutional recipe, a sort of mix of, you know, politics and all the rest of it, that allowed the Elon Musks or, you know, the big entrepreneurs of that time to flourish and to change things, but not to acquire the political clout to be able to change the rules in the game. And it's a really difficult thing, I have to say. There's no fixed line. You just got to be wary a little bit of the kind of the charismatic individual, I think, in a way, that sort of, you know, developed world democracies and the kind of liberal institutional architecture. It's kind of a defense against it, even though freedom of the individual is really important. Slightly off patch, but you know what I mean.
No, it was very interesting insight and examples, as always. Hadn't heard of that one before either, so it's always good to get new insight.
It's the same as the one that, I mean, one of our behavioral guys always talks about this, with the idea that we all have a bias to think we are brilliant, and we are all kind of, you know, in any success, we tend to underrate luck and overrate our own agency and incredibleness and all-round awesomeness. And the good example that's often given in sort of behavioral circles is the idea that 80% of drivers, I think in the UK, maybe UK, maybe US, I'll have to sort of fact check this, but a huge proportion of drivers, 80% is the number that comes to my head, think they're better than average. Obviously, that can't be right, but it's the kind of idea, isn't it? That, you know, at some point, you know, maybe that's necessary that we think we're awesome. That's part of the sort of, you know,
thing. I mean, I'm in the 20% when it comes to driving
good honesty. That's exactly what we want.
No, exactly. And this is kind of the statistics and stuff that help bring everything to life as well, and kind of giving real life examples from history and kind of how we're then applying that to modern day examples.
You're too generous, Sophie. Your predecessors wouldn't have allowed me any leeway on that, but yes.
And I mean, surely this is all kind of relevant as well to the political sphere, and I guess especially this year, with all of the elections that we've got coming up. I mean, India, US, Europe, UK, and elsewhere still to come. How does it all kind of feed into that?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, I mean, this is the kind of, you know, the moment we're in is very much about the sort of charismatic individuals and the kind of, you know, that populist allure, which is always kind of sort of encapsulated in an individual, usually someone from the kind of elite circles themselves, you know, able to sort of characterize themselves as against the elite. You know, I'm for you, the people, and I'm against that. And that's kind of this moment we seem to be living through. And really interestingly, and again, I'm sorry, there's a bit of history, but I was reading a book this week that was quite interesting on this point. And it was a sort of the moment we're in, to a certain degree, was part of a prediction of many early political philosophers. And essentially, once you broadened the sort of the franchise, the people who were able to vote, you would need ever more kind of charismatic individuals to be able to reach that ever more disparate base, to be able to connect with people emotionally and otherwise, which is, and so in a sense, you require more checks and balances as a result. And actually, the example given, you know, was that in the French, you know, 18th century, military service was a route, and this is a little bit of another side, sorry, but it was interesting, I thought, this just as a sort of talk about war and democracy. And basically in France in the sort of late 18th century, military service became a route to citizenship. And it dates back to kind of Athenian democracy. Essentially, you know, after you've asked a citizen to kill or be killed on behalf of the country, it's quite hard, quite mean-spirited to turn around and say, no, you can't have any citizenship rights or voting. And so what you find is you saw a lot of this in the First World War. So, you know, you saw dramatic expansions of people who could vote. You know, not just men expanded to all of that bit, but also you increasingly saw women particularly where they were seen as central to the war effort. And also, you know, in France, African Muslim migrants, so military service allowed citizenship and you know, voting rights. It didn't stick perfectly. Some of it got retraced, but you can see the point. And it's kind of the difficult thing about this kind of balance we're in at the moment is how do you have freedom of the individual, which is central to productivity growth, as we know. You know, if you need people to come up with crazy ideas, you need to make room in your society for the misfits, the weirdos, the people, you know, everyone who has sort of crazy ideas and sort of, you know, it's diversity, equity and inclusion at a national scale, basically. And it's really important in the productivity process. However, how do you protect against the idea that one of those individuals can get too much power? And actually, we are innately quite fallible. You know, we've got all sorts of behavioral problems. We kind of tend to, like I say, we go back to that point. I think there's it's called self-selection bias, self-attribution bias. Okay. It's this idea that, you know, it's particularly prevalent among some entrepreneurs, which is quite an important trait in entrepreneurs sometimes. And please don't take any offense, any entrepreneurs on the line. But what you tend to find is that a lot of this is in America, that, you know, your mega, mega wealthy entrepreneurs, they often overrate their own role in their success, even though they've clearly had a role, and they underrate the role of sort of other factors like their upbringing. You know, quite a lot of them started from a privileged position, not all of them. That, you know, the government provides quite a lot of the sort of ground, the surrounding sort of environment that allows them to flourish, but they de-emphasize that in favor of their own age. Naturally, of course they do. But that's quite dangerous in a way, you know, thinking about these, you know, this moment we're in. I'm sorry, I'm sort of all over the place in terms of answers at the moment, but you're getting some of my weird thoughts.
It's good to get kind of different perspective on different topics as well that we wouldn't normally cover. But
I'm
going to lean you back more into elections.
Yes.
With that in mind, though, I guess, as well. And one of the worries, I think, in the US is about a much more kind of global consequential replay of what we saw with former Prime Minister Truss and her administration. I mean, we see President Trump arguing for more tax cuts, tariffs, full stop on immigration. Surely this is something that the team are worried about.
So certainly, you know, you're right, Sophia. I mean, in market terms, you know, people are looking not just at, you know, a prospective President Trump, but they're looking at the current sort of shape of government spending, revenues versus spending in the US. And there's what's called, you know, quite a large deficit. And that's quite unusual. That's quite a large deficit between what you're bringing in taxes and what you're spending out on all sorts of stuff. Now, so your debt pile ultimately is growing and people are worrying about this because they're starting to say, well, you know, in the old kind of economic world, you're supposed to kind of mend the roof when the economic sun is shining. So you kind of, you know, rebuild your deficit or you get back into surplus, you're a bit more careful with your money. But actually, kind of the US seems to be spending like a drunken sailor, even though the economy is kind of doing quite well. Now, that's a mischaracterization, as you can imagine. But the idea is, and President Trump is certainly sort of, you know, he's kind of advertised himself quite clearly on sort of a number of fronts that he wants to sort of finish off the tax cut that he did in office the first time round. One of the kind of thought to be known knowns about his administration is a guy called Robert Lighthizer, who's going to be his trade secretary again if he gets in. And Robert Lighthizer has written a book where he describes exactly what he plans to do. And it's called, I think it's called No Free Trade. And it tells you exactly, really, the hints. And he wants to slap big tariffs on everyone, you know, all this kind of thing. Now, the problem you get to in that situation is there's a relationship between, you know, putting tariffs on everybody and your dollar, because President Trump also likes a weak dollar because that supports domestic manufacturing and a lot of his kind of base and ideas. The reverse would happen if he does a lot of these policies, and they would obviously be quite inflationary, because one of the things that's cooling inflation in the US at the moment is actually, it's politically unpopular but economically successful, is the immigration story. So there's a whole load going on. I would personally make two weird points. One, again, the point that we've made repeatedly about sort of President Trump, President Biden, you know, even any changes in democracy, you know, leadership here, is that, you know, it gets back to that kind of Enlightenment constitution points we sort of started off with, which is, you know, the checks and balances, is that these economies now are way too big, too complicated, too various to answer to one individual. There's a huge amount of preset economic momentum, which is really what we're investing in as a result. And we often exaggerate the kind of agency of individuals, even though they can be influential and all those kind of things. The other thing which is really interesting on the immigration side of things, and I know this is a kind of, you know, this is a very emotive subject, and rightly so, and it's kind of, there's no clean answers, and a lot of the sort of debate is hideously reductive, but there's a really interesting link between immigration and entrepreneurship, which is, you know, because you find in the US a lot of these really successful companies, the entrepreneurs have come from other countries, they're immigrants, and that's obviously, you know, the US, the story of the US, the founding story to a degree. And there is quite a sort of, in terms of behavioral kind of psychological traits, there's quite a lot of overlap, you know, intuitively between someone who is willing to take their family from a country and uproot them and bring them all the way over to another country. Huge risk, you know, and the idea of, you know, there's overlap there between also the instincts to start up a company and take those same risks. So there is some interesting kind of behavioral stuff going on. I don't want to make comment on all the other really difficult, you know, situations, you know, difficult issues on that, but it's just one interesting.
Yeah, no, most definitely not something, again, I'd come across before either. I'm going to jump back a step almost, though, back to the topic of government debt. I know it's a topic that we have covered a lot, but surely there is some sort of limit in terms of the amount that these governments can borrow, and particularly now more than ever, where we are seeing interest rates now likely to stay a bit higher for a bit longer.
There must be. I agree. There must be. I'm not sure. There's the, you know, this debate goes back to, you know, the aftermath of the great financial crisis, when people sort of, there was a famous academic paper which argued that it was an 80% limit in terms of debt to GDP. That was wrong. It's been sort of, you know, the analysis, they were hugely clever, very garlanded economists, but they made some quite famous elementary errors in the aftermath, you know, as people studied it. And the answer, I think, is that that limit on debt is much less knowable than we think it is, because in a sense, Britain's previous kind of instances with much higher debt piles have been eroded mostly not by inflation, but by growth. And actually, productivity is generally the answer. You know, that, you know, debt to GDP after Britain had spanked Napoleon was 250% of GDP. And it was paid down to, I think, 25% of GDP by 1900. And it was not a period of austerity. It was growth. Now, there must be a limit, though, all the same. But I think that idea of kind of Prime Minister Truss and the sort of the Chancellor Kwanteng kind of moment, there's loads of different interpretations. You know, is it that, you know, people were worried about, you know, unfunded tax cuts and that sort of, you know, the debt pile suddenly being on an unsustainable level? Interestingly, kind of, you know, the people, policymakers that followed them have done much the same thing, but the tone was very different. Mm. And my hunch, and it could be no more than that, is that, you know, when people are lending to governments, and we do too through our pensions and all sorts of things, and we own government debt, we lend to the government through our, you know, many kind of investment arms as individuals and as a business, what we're looking for is kind of grey and boring to agree. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to see, like, when you're lending someone loads of money, you don't want to see them kind of do wild stuff. You kind of want a very boring, predictable. It's the same kind of thing. And this is a bad comparison again, but it's kind of me, you know, wandering into a Barclays branch with my tie around my head and some sort of, you know, weird things and saying, I want loads of money, but I'm not sure I'm going to work. And that's not a good comparison with what Prime Minister Truss did. But if you see what I mean, that's kind of, that's going to either not get me a loan or it's going to get me a much higher interest rate. So I think that's the same thing to think about with international investors, is they're not looking politically in a sense. They're not thinking, oh, I don't like those people. They're just looking for people who they feel there's safe hands on the tiller and therefore their loan is safe. I hope that's not going to get me sacked, but we'll see.
Offers a comment.
Yeah, you're doing well. Steer clear of it.
So another topic I've seen in the news this week, and also kind of clients commenting around, was the news that the FTSE 100 had an all-time high at close this week. And surely that's kind of a positive sentiment. There's a story around that. I'm just wondering if you can shed any light on that.
Yes. It's good news, Sophie. All-time highs are good news. I mean, the interesting thing about all-time highs on stock markets, either in total return or price terms, is that generally we get lots of calls from investors, understandably sort of saying, well, why am I going to buy that now? Like, it seems like a perversion of the, you know, the time-honored buy low, sell high, rather than the reverse. And so people always get a bit of sort of a kind of vertigo when you get to these all-time highs, like what's going on? But the interesting thing is that, you know, in a growing economy, growing global economy, the major stock markets should be reaching all-time highs all the time, and do, if you look at the US market, for instance. And that's because, you know, these markets, their valuation, their price, their return, it anchors to the level of corporate profits generated by that particular indices index. And in a growing economy, that should be reaching new all-time highs all the time. So really, over time, all-time highs shouldn't be a news story, but they are, and it's good news because the UK has been quite out of favour for some time for fashion reasons as much as kind of the makeup of its index. So it's quite heavy on sort of, you know, commodities and some of the other sort of less popular or less currently popular. Maybe they're coming back into fashion soon, like ripped jeans.
So I think we'll take it as it's an all-time high for now, but not an all-time high for forever. Let's maybe finish off on talking about the world economy. Are there any major changes to our views on what's happening over there?
Over here, over there.
Over here, there, everywhere.
It could be everywhere. No, not too major. I mean, the interesting thing that just sort of thinking about a bit this week with the team was the differences between the US and Europe in the post-COVID piece, and just looking at, because there's a really, you know, when we went into, and I was talking to clients about this last night, funny enough, down in Paul Plymouth got me yesterday, so we were talking about this. I was boring. I sent three people to sleep in a crowd of 50, but it was, which I thought was quite a good ratio, but anyway, this was part of what I sent them to sleep with, so be careful, listeners, was during COVID, when it came along and arrived in our economies, these two very different regions decided to deal with it differently. So everyone agreed we need to shut these economies down because, you know, we've got economies reliant on face-to-face transactions. That's obviously not a good idea with a pandemic coming. And so in the US, they allowed people to make people redundant. And so you saw unemployment. I mean, it rose to a shocking degree. It literally went through the sort of Great Depression level in about 5 minutes, and it was a terrifying chart. And you just thought, oh my gosh. And then in the UK and Europe, they decided to what's called preserve labour market matches. And so companies kept employees, but the government sort of pumped money through the companies into the employees, whereas in the US, they wrote them checks directly. I'm oversimplifying, but you get the point. Now, the interesting thing is that now there's been a pickup in US productivity. And one of the arguments is that many of those people who were laid off, because this has been a time of change and kind of, you know, productivity change, that actually those people re-entered the labor market, but in better jobs, better fits. And so they felt more productive, they felt better fits. And many of them went off and started up businesses. So there's been this surge in kind of business formation in the US. Whereas in Europe and the UK, you're seeing quite interesting trends in kind of participation, which is a bit more sluggish. It's kind of just a bit, there's a bit less of a dynamic story there. That maybe not for keeps, but it's something quite interesting. But actually, you know, quite usefully, you are seeing a pickup in some of the kind of lead indicators for Europe and the UK. Some of the data has been getting better. I think you and Francis talked about this last week. So yes, I'd say things are brightening a little bit. I hope, we hope. Everything's going to be fine.
Absolutely.
Don't quote me on that. Well, I've said it on a podcast now, so I am. Yes.
No, that's perfect. And thanks so much, Will, for your valuable insight as always. We'll see you back next week for more, no doubt, updates on market, geopolitics, inflation. So thanks everyone for listening.
All investments can fall as well as rise in value, and their past performance is not a reliable indicator of future performance. This podcast is not a personal investment recommendation.